Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been my singular delight to get to know over the years and to have an opportunity to, tap into the intelligence of our guest for this full hour-long program of Secure Freedom Radio, a man I've come to believe is among the most thoughtful, incisive, and certainly entertaining of observers of and participants in the war for the free world. He is Mark Helprin. He is better known to most of us as an extraordinarily accomplished author of both fiction and nonfiction works, the most recent of which, a highly acclaimed novel, is Paris in the Present Tense. He is also, however, an essayist of considerable accomplishment, notably on the pages of the Wall Street Journal, but most other places that matter as well. He has been very gracious to visit with us from time to time, and the timing couldn't be more fortuitous, as far as I'm concerned, because we've caught up with him in the aftermath of President Trump's speech to the nation unveiling his new national security strategy in Washington, D.C. And it's, as I say, a great privilege to have Mark anytime, but particularly to have a chance to visit with him in real time about the president's remarks and his plans for our national security is both an honor and simply providential. Mark Helprin, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, let's start with sort of your general assessment of what the president said and the apparent underpinnings of what he said in this new national security plan.
Well, I actually was very happy with the speech. I think it has the marks, I think, of Stephen Miller, who wrote his other really good speech that he delivered in Europe about American values and defense. I think it was fundamentally excellent. Some of the weak points in that it was short on specifics and there were some mistaken assumptions. But the really good part of it was, first, it was good to recognize the relation of GDP and GDP growth to military capacity. This is what the Chinese have recognized in the past 20 or 30 years and what has brought them to the point of being a near peer of the United States. This is what kept Israel alive, has kept Israel alive, and it's what also brought the Meiji into competition with the European powers and then the United States. The recognition that GDP growth and per capita GDP is the basic source of military power. I was also happy that the president announced that he was getting rid of the sequester, if he can indeed do that, because he's not Congress, and there are Democrats in Congress. And also generally increasing defense expenditure, although he tends to speak in terms of absolute figures rather than inflation-adjusted figures. So when he says that the tax cut is the biggest in American history, that's in absolute dollars. If you adjust it for inflation or even look at it just in terms of percentages, it certainly isn't. The Reagan tax cuts were. But it's also excellent of him to recognize that defense buildup is good for the economy. And there are many, many ways to prove that. We probably don't have time to go into that, but there is no question that the idea that the military must wait for the economy is incorrect, because the military is spending is actually a great stimulus for the economy. It can even be a method of organization that tremendously helps the economy. If you look at the Great Depression and World War II, specifically, you find absolutely unimpeachable evidence of that. And the weak points, I think, were, oh, and of course, the call for multi-layered BMD was excellent because missile defense, because we have restrained ourselves to a mid-course interception, and what we have to have is boost phase and also end the terminal interception, because that's the only way that you can conceivably begin to protect is with layers, because one or more of those layers is going to miss. So if you have one after another, you have a better chance of actually protecting against at the very least, rogue regimes like North Korea or Iran.
Yeah. I want to drill down on some of these points with you, Mark, in greater detail here in a minute. But you wanted to say a few words about some of the speech's shortcomings. So let's hit those two, and then we'll get into the details.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the president is a man who is not particularly interested or knowledgeable in or knowledgeable about details. And he made the mistake that he has made before by talking about NATO reimbursing the United States in terms of defense expenditures, when this has never been the case. So what NATO does is try to hit a target of 3% of GNP, and when it doesn't do that,
or 2%, as the case may be.
Yeah, well, when it doesn't do that, that's right. I'm sorry, it's 2%.
We used to do three when we were remotely serious about the war we're in, but now it's, I think, at best 2.
That's right. And under Obama, the last year of Obama, it actually slipped to a smidgen below 3 for the United States, not counting overseas contingency spending. But anyway, NATO doesn't reimburse us. However, when it fails, as it does, as it has, to spend adequately on defense, we have to fill the gap. But on the other hand, we haven't, given what we have in Europe or the lack of it. So the whole thing is somewhat confused in his mind. But it is good that the United States has been pressuring them, and it has worked to some extent to spend more on their defense, because they need it, frankly. And then the other weak point was they talked about another weak point. We talked about sanctions on the North Korea. That they're more or less irrelevant. The sanctions are not going to drive North Korea to abandon its nuclear capacity unless they come vigorously from China, which has 90% of its trade. And they're not going to work. And we have not made much progress in defanging North Korea. There are many ways that we could do that. I could talk about them, but that's irrelevant to the speech. Finally, Frank, he hasn't gotten into detail. The document is 65 pages long, and I haven't read it. I haven't had a chance to read it. But there's very little in terms of specifics. Not mentioned in the speech is the one key thing which anchors everything, and that is the absolute decline in America's nuclear deterrent. And I don't mean floppy disks and software or whatever, but I'm talking about the structure of it vis-a-vis Russia's and China's structure. We are in the weakest position that we have been in ever in terms of nuclear deterrence, and that's something I would very much like to talk about.
Yeah, well, let's do that right away, because this is of surpassing importance. Mark, in a program we did last week on this show, one of our guests assessed that the Russians appear now to be on a trajectory to have 8,000 nuclear weapons, I believe, by the middle of the next decade. And I mentioned this in a meeting of my staff today, and somebody pointed out that not only would that be multiple times the size of the U.S. arsenal, all other things being equal, but every single one of those nuclear weapons and the missiles or aircraft that they're on will be modernized. Some of the aircraft may be a little bit older, but certainly the missiles, certainly the warheads and bombs themselves are modern, we expect, thanks to the kind of aggressive buildup that the Russians have engaged in. And none of ours is modern at all.
In sum, here's the thing. First, If you don't have nuclear deterrence, you're setting yourself up either for a first strike against you, which might succeed, or B, having to surrender on every front all over the world.
I need to ask you to hold that thought, Mark, because that is indeed the crux of the matter. We'll be right back with much more with Mark Halperin, author, commentator, great American, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for a full hour the end of this very, very busy and portentous year, I think it's fair to say, 2017, with Mark Halperin, man we've had the privilege of speaking with off and on in the course of the year, but always look forward to taking stock with at its end. And in particular, today, to assessing what the president has laid out for us as a new national security strategy for our country. And Mark, you were describing something that I am convinced most Americans haven't given any thought to at all for most of the past 30 years. And that is the condition, let alone the importance of credible, safe, reliable, effective nuclear deterrent. And you've just starkly described what that portends if we have really lost that deterrent posture. And I would argue we are at the cusp of it if we haven't actually done so.
Oh, we have. We have. And if I can sort of, again, in a nutshell, because this is complicated stuff, but here's the thing. First, I'll describe what's wrong with our deterrent, and then I'll describe the other sides. First of all, we are exceedingly vulnerable to a first strike in that, A, we do not have an adequate missile defense so that we can't stop anything coming in to attack our counterforce. In other words, our missiles that might make a retaliatory strike. Secondly, our land-based missiles are all in silos. They're in the very near future. We and the Russians and the Chinese will have precision guidance to the millimeter. It used to be circular error probable, where they would say, because of weather, et cetera, even with MIRVs, you might be off by a mile or a half a mile, or certainly in terms of multiple meters or yards. Now, the new precision guidance coming on is accurate to the millimeter, so that even with conventional weapons, it might be possible to destroy land-based missiles which are fixed in silos.
Even quite hardened silos.
Even hardened silos, with penetrators. Now, to counter that, on the other side, the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans have mobile missiles. We do not. Even the North Koreans have mobile missiles. You can bet that Iran will have them too. The United States has foregone mobile missiles, which is a way of protecting land-based missiles from precision strikes. Okay, that's the one leg of the triad. The second leg is air bases, aircraft. Our aircraft are not only almost as old as I am, and I'm 70 years old, but except for the B-2, which is, we only have 20 of them, and they're the only ones that can actually penetrate air defenses, Russian air defenses, possibly Chinese air defenses. But they're based on four bases, and that may, of course, they can be dispersed, but they're exceedingly vulnerable because in addition to hitting their bases and destroying them, and the bases are not adequately hardened, as they should be, in addition, Russia has great air defenses. Okay, then the third leg of the triad is the safest, which is the undersea triad. We used to have 41 ballistic missile submarines. Then we went to 18. Then we went to 14. And the new class, the Columbia class, will be 10. If you have 10 Columbia class submarines, the maximum that could be at sea at any one time is 6. And both, if you take Russia and China together, they have 100 hunter-killer submarines. That's not the only thing. Sea transparency is growing. The Russians have figured out But you can track submarines now as it's never before, because even when they go at great depths, what they make is an upwelling of minerals and other such things that leave a track on the surface. So that these submarines now, the seas are more transparent than they've ever been, and the Russians can track submarines now with non-acoustic means. There you have and some other things. Both the Russians and the Chinese, and the Koreans actually too, have tunneled. The Chinese, it is reported anyway, have 5,000 kilometers or roughly 3,000 miles of tunnels in which their nuclear infrastructure is housed. So we don't even know what they have. And then there's another thing, and that is that we have arms control agreement with Russia, and that keeps us at a certain point. Do we have an arms control agreement with China? No. And they are building up their nuclear deterrent or nuclear forces to the point where they will come to parity with us and with Russia, because they have the economic heft to do that. And we don't even know what they have in those tunnels.
It could well surpass what we have actually agreed to limit ourselves to. And then, of course, there's the problem, Mark Halperin, that the Russians have apparently put themselves in a position to be unbound by those agreements. So we could be facing, in addition to all of that, both qualitative and quantitative advantages in the hands of our enemies. The qualitative including, as you know, hypersonic weapons and maneuvering weapons against which our defenses at present are probably totally ineffectual. You've described a great and ominous nuclear threat on the one hand, but again, let me ask you about one other piece of this. The extent to which we have allowed ourselves to be qualitatively outmatched, as well as perhaps putting ourselves in a position of being exceedingly vulnerable.
First of all, we scrupulously hold to the arms agreements, and the Russians, as we know, do not, and there is no such agreement with China. So that you have a possibility of a massive disadvantage in terms of numbers. And that means something, at least, at the very least, psychologically. Then there's the question of, again, penetration. What means do they have to penetrate any missile defenses we may have? And what do we have in terms of penetrating their defenses, some of which we don't even know what they are? But the main thing is that the American people have been led to believe that getting rid of nuclear weapons is the safe way to go, and that what we need is to simply get rid of nuclear weapons. Well, first of all, even if that were so, you would want to have at least some semblance of equality in doing that, and we don't have that either with Russia or with China, where China is not even obligated to do so. But even if we did have that semblance, even if we had inspections, et cetera, if indeed we got rid of our nuclear weapons and Russia and or China kept secretly in caves their nuclear weapons, then they could rule the world and we would be nowhere. And you can take a nuclear arsenal sufficient to destroy the United States, and talking about the warheads now, and put them in a normal-sized apartment.
To say nothing of 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels, needless to say. And Mark, one other piece of this, which is also of concern and rarely gets the attention it deserves, is, as you were starting to say, the lengths to which the North Koreans, to say nothing of the Russians and Chinese, have really burrowed in. We've talked a little bit about tunnels, but in addition, you also have hardened submarine pens built into mountainsides, for example. And these are the sorts of and underground command centers and the like.
Yeah, China has hardened submarine pens on Hainan Island in the South China Sea. And our bases are just completely vulnerable.
Even to conventional attack, as you've indicated, which is alarming in the extreme. Mark, we have to pause, but when we come back, I'd like to switch gears to what we might do to try to contend with the implications of what you've just said by having missile defenses in place that would be capable of dealing with, hopefully at the very minimum, making uncertain in the minds of the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans or others, what the effects of an attack would be, which again has the potential to enhance deterrence to some degree. We'll talk about that and other parts of the president's new national security strategy right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are visiting with Mark Helprin, a world-class literary genius, as well as a strategist of the First Order. He visits with us, as well as other outlets like the Wall Street Journal, from time to time to shed light on some of the challenges the country is facing. And we've caught up with him at a moment when President Trump has laid out his ideas about how to deal with them. And we're working our way through some of the highlights of that national security strategy, as it's called. And Mark, as you pointed out earlier, the president made a point of emphasizing the importance of having layered ballistic missile defenses. Would you give us your assessment of how effective those defenses are today, even before you throw into the mix these maneuvering and hypersonic weapons that are now beginning to be fielded by our adversaries, and what we should be doing in this regard?
Well, first of all, you would need the layers to make a sufficient defense of our counterforce assets. Counterforce assets mean the missiles and airplanes or whatever that could make a retaliatory strike. That's the most important defense, because what it says to an enemy is, if the enemy strikes us, we can strike them back. The ballistic missile defense originally was envisioned by Reagan as being a way to, at least politically, he presented it this way, to protect cities and civilians. Well, yes, it is, and infrastructure, to a point. But it's actually impossible to do that to the point where it would mean much, although it would save some lives. The main purpose of it would be to protect our retaliatory capacity, and that would stay a first strike. Now, at this point, our missile defenses, because of the shrinkage of our nuclear assets, and meaning that there's that many fewer of them, that and lots of them are stable and fixed in position, because of that shrinkage, and old, but and not necessarily reliable, but because of that shrinkage and the fixed positions, et cetera, that they become that much more vulnerable to an adversary that is built up, who might even risk doing that. Tempting. You know, this is where, in one sense, we have a way out. And if you combine Bob Work's idea of the third offset, meaning advances in technology, with proper funding and the political decision to actually deploy such things, we might actually work our way out of it. For instance, you mentioned hypervelocity projectiles. And these are things that can be launched from railguns, or which are electric rather than powder, or even from conventional artillery tubes. And they have their own guidance. They go extremely fast, many times the speed of sound. And they are actually capable of intercepting a ballistic missile. Then there's laser defense. We don't have powerful enough lasers now to intercept an ICBM or even an intermediate range missile, but we're getting there. And that could be either on the ground or deployed in space. And then there's the political decision to deploy boost phase missile defense, which again, it's a political decision, because it's a big deal. The opposition to that from the left would be immense. But that's very important, because that's where missiles in their boost phase are going very relatively slowly, and they can be hit. So between lasers and hypervelocity projectiles and layering, et cetera, we certainly should, with the proper expenditure, with the sufficient expenditure, have enough capacity to protect our retaliatory capacity.
But not necessarily our people, unless the combination of the two has that effect. But Mark, one thing you haven't mentioned, which I'm hanging on, is the idea of most efficiently, and I've been told most effectively, providing that kind of layered defense, particularly in the boost phase, as it's called, from space. Are you discounting that, or is that part of what you would envision is needed?
I mentioned that.
Did you? I missed it.
Okay. Yeah, of lasers in space, because obviously if they're in space, they have far less distance to travel, and in the vacuum of space, you don't have atmospheric interference, so that you multiply the potential power of a laser immensely. But
20 years ago or so, more I guess now, we were using fairly prosaic techniques, what were then called brilliant pebbles, to do this kind of space defense. I mean, lasers have always appealed to me, but they do seem to be complicated and expensive. I just wonder whether if we set our minds to having a truly comprehensive program, which the president seems to be talking about, we can't do it cheaper and faster than that approach may entail. Let me switch gears on you, Mark, because one of the other things that the president has alluded to and that the national security strategy refers to as well is the danger that adversaries of this country, notably but not exclusively the North Koreans, they just happen to be talking about it a lot, might threaten the most critical of critical infrastructures in our country, namely our electric grid, with something called electromagnetic attacks, or EMP, electromagnetic pulse attacks. Is that, in your judgment, a real Achilles heel for this country? And if so, how seriously should we be pursuing protecting our grid, as well as these other things you've mentioned?
Oh, I've been on this for decades now. Of course, if you think about the effect of a power outage on your local town,
or the Atlanta airport, or Puerto Rico, or New York City,
when it happened in New York, everything freezes. Farmers wouldn't be able to produce food. Wells wouldn't pump. There'd be traffic jams. There wouldn't be heat in the winter. There wouldn't be air conditioning in the summer. Hospitals would run out of their generator fuel because people couldn't actually pump gas to get it out, to get it into hospitals. And with an EMP, also vehicles wouldn't go either. So there would be immense anarchy, and then a tremendous shortage of foodstuffs and medicines and water, clean water. Disease would break out. People would organize into bands and begin to slaughter each other to get whatever food stocks were still preserved. It would be an immense disaster.
It's a nation-ending problem, in other words. So this is being now discussed in this strategy as something we have to attend to, which is kind of a breakthrough. I don't think, other than sort of congressional commissions and the like, that we've actually had that kind of direction announced, certainly at the level of the President of the United States. So what should we be doing to try to address this danger?
On the most basic level, I suppose from an academic strategic point of view, what we have to do is threaten to completely destroy anyone who would attempt this against us, because it would be destruction. It might be in the guise of saying, oh, well, we happened to blow a nuclear weapon high in the atmosphere. No one was killed. But then the effects of it...
Lots of people will be.
Would be, 90 million, 100 million, 200 million people would die, and the nation would end. So we have to make that clear in terms of our retaliatory policy. But that's just academic. It's actually on the ground, doing something physically. For one, protect the electric grid, harden it. The transformers that would blow take, 18 months to order? And most of them are manufactured in Korea, in South Korea. We should have a stockpile of those. We should have stockpiles of things that were necessary to reestablish the electric grid once this happened. But, that wouldn't actually do it, because we are so computer dependent, and the very few things, even military assets, are not hardened against EMP. it would just by reestablishing the electrical grid would not necessarily save the nation because we are so dependent upon computation.
It's a necessary but not a sufficient condition, I guess, is
That's
what you're
right.
getting at, Mark Helprin. And I think the point you're more broadly making is that we cannot afford to tarry in taking the steps to protect the electric grid as well as our nuclear deterrent capabilities. I mean, there's a world of things to do. The president absolutely is going to have to get out from under this defense sequestration in order to do it. More with Mark Helprin right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We are back for our final segment with Mark Helprin, author extraordinaire and strategic thinker of great and, I think, appropriate renown. He visits with us from time to time from the Claremont Institute, where he is a senior fellow. He is the author most recently of a splendid new novel, Paris in the Present Tense, and we are always pleased to have a chance to chat with him, but especially to help think through what President Trump has said and laid out as his vision for securing the United States in the years ahead. And Mark, I was just saying that in particular, I was heartened to hear him talking about this threat from an ideology that animates, as you know so well, having served in the Israeli army and lived in the Middle East and elsewhere around the world, as well as, of course, following all of these developments very, very closely, is fundamentally, at the end of the day, an ideological program for power and control and worldwide domination. And as the president said, what the adherents to this ideology call it is Sharia. I'm interested in your thoughts about both the clarity of that point, that we face Sharia supremacism, and whether you think we've got a scheme for dealing with it effectively.
Number one of the problems that we've had since way before September 11th is identifying our enemy. And if you can't identify, you don't have the courage to identify your enemy because of either pressure from allies or pressure from the enemy himself, or pressure from your own people who are, in my view, misguided, then what you know, you can't really fight effectively if you can't even say what it is you're fighting against, if you can't recognize it. And more or less, the Islamic world has been at war with the, lack of a better term, the Christian world for ages now. And we have grown up, most of the people who have been educated in not only my generation, but certainly, actually it's less so in younger generations, but for hundreds of years, the Islamic world has been absolutely subdued by superior European and then somewhat American power. And therefore, we think that, well, because they were subdued, they were tossed back into fatalism, and they were very quiescent because they were so weak, that impulse to fight against the Christian world has gone. Well, it never left, and it's still here, and now it has emerged in hot spots all over the place in the Islamic world, which, let me be clear, this is not to say that all Muslims are like this. That's certainly not the case. You have to take people individually, one by one. But institutionally, in the madrasas and in the institutes of higher learning, with exceptions, it's changing in certain places. For instance, I hope that the new regime in Saudi Arabia is moves in a positive direction. But more or less, the war between the two civilizations has erupted once again.
And this brings me to the crux of this matter. The president, as you mentioned, went to Saudi Arabia. He spoke of it today to essentially call on the emerging Saudi ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, and his father, King Salman, to drive out these Sharia supremacists. He didn't use it in that particular setting, but I think that was his point. And indeed, he called on all of the other Muslim leaders present. I was struck by the prospect that every single one of them just about would have had to get up and leave the room if present company were included. But to the extent, as you've seen it, up close and personal in Israel, for example, can there be any other solution to this problem when you're dealing with people who have been now emboldened by our seeming lack of clarity about what they're doing, our transferring of gigabillions of dollars to them in the form of petro wealth, our, they perceive it as submission, let's be honest. Is there any other way to deal with that threat than to disabuse them of the notion through kinetic means, if necessary, and certainly through a countervailing, counter-ideological strategy, which I'm hoping is what the president has in mind?
Yeah, well, I mean, it has to be, again, it's like the layered missile defense. First of all, you have to be clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and you have to be explicit. And it, there was a step towards being explicit. Secondly, you have to offer incentives, such as alliance. In this case now, we have the Iranians who are Shia, who are threatening the Sunni world. So we are now allying with the Sunni world, and there are great changes there. And if you look at Assisi in Egypt and at Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia and even Abdullah in Jordan, although he's sitting on a keg of very volatile Palestinians, those three are, with the exception of Assisi, Western educated. I think they're sympathetic to the West. I think that they're a great hope, and they've been pushed toward us and toward Israel by the Iranian threat, which is major, building a bridge from Afghanistan all the way to the Mediterranean very successfully thus far because we've let them, because Obama let them. But so you have being explicit about it, taking good care to support the allies that we might have in the Islamic world, and Indonesia too is a possibility because they tend towards moderate Islam. And at the same time, being really tough about how we react to provocations and terrorism, and at the same time, not being seduced by nation building in nations that cannot be built.
And not being seduced either by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is pursuing these same goals through somewhat more subtle, shall we say, stealthy and insidious techniques, even in our own country. I think the president is beginning to even McMaster, his national security advisor, who I think has been such a disaster on so many of these counts, has seemingly got his head around that. It's heartening to say. Let me ask you finally, Mark, just because of your time in Israel, you mentioned the Palestinian powder keg. The president, of course, recently announced that we're going to recognize the reality that Israel's capital is Jerusalem and would move our embassy to it. Your thoughts on his initiative and its importance?
Well, I have to say that, you know, I'm biased, but I've been for that for decades and decades. And I think if there's any explanation, we'll undoubtedly see some terrorism, which is supposedly based upon that. That would be not too much new, just a question of labeling. And there might even be some sort of proto-new intifada. I don't know. I wouldn't think so. But here's the thing you have to remember. Just like anybody, the Arabs are very impressed by the strong horse. And if you essentially hide your light under a bushel and you don't act in a decisive, strong, courageous way, they're going to take advantage of it. On the other hand, if you're direct and you say, well, look, these are our principles, this is what we support, this is what we think is right, it's not as if Israel and the United States are weak sisters compared to the Palestinians. All they can do, really, is sacrifice their own people in order to get news coverage and gain world sympathy.
And that only gets you so far. This is such an important point, Mark Helprin. It's one of the reasons why I enjoy visiting with you whenever we can, because it just really cuts through a lot of the nonsense that you hear from the foreign policy elite so often. But the respect for power and the contempt for weakness, which is only surpassed, it seems to me, in this community of Sharia supremacists, most especially by the contempt they have for people who have power but lack the will to use it, is such an important understanding of the threat we're facing and the need to rise to it, as you have shared with us your insights on so many others. I have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you, Mark, for this really important contribution to our end of the year wrap-up. I look forward to talking with you early and often in 2018. That's it for today. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.